It's like a warm sea. A soft breeze. The rustle of the leaves in the trees. Flowers. And butterflies. Beautiful.
Sita was played by Meera Sial, Raj and the Boy by Isha Ladi, Sophia by Meg Fraser, and Omit, Pradeep and the Fishmonger by Takai Nazir. Death of a Matriarch was written by Tanika Gupta and produced by Polly Thomas. It was a Naked production for BBC Radio 3.
You're listening to Drama on 3 on BBC Radio 3 with a series of new plays recorded in front of an audience at Summerhall Arts Centre as part of the Edinburgh Festival Fringe. Three letters. Written and performed by Nell Lyshen.
I am 12 years old. I'm standing in the wings of the theatre and I'm waiting for my cue. The music changes and I hesitate, but a hand in the small of my back pushes me forward and I step into the light. There are faces looking at me, hundreds of eyes looking at me. I stand where they told me to stand. I wear the clothes they told me to wear. I have a head full of words they told me to speak. My skin begins to fight with the fabric. The words clot in my mouth. I want to step backwards, to the back of the stage, back, 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 until I disappear into the black cloth. But I don't. I stand in the lights with all the eyes looking at me and I make a vow to myself. I will never, ever stand on a stage again. I will never do this again. It is October and the leaves are hanging on. It's late evening and I'm driving home from London from city to sea, and as I'm driving, I am thinking. I'm thinking about the woman I am now that my two sons have left home, and I'm thinking about the woman that I was before they were born. And I'm trying to see the relationship between these two women. I don't even know anymore when I'm on my own if I prefer a bath or a shower. And I don't even know exactly what it is that I want to eat. And I don't know what it is that I want to write now that I have long, uninterrupted days. The motorway becomes the forest. I can see the sulphurous lights of the town, and I enter the suburban streets. I go under the railway line and up the hill, and at the top I turn into home, switch off the engine. When I open the car door, I breathe in the smell of sea salt and privet hedge. In the house, behind the front door, there is a letter waiting for me. I pick it up from the mat and I carry it into the kitchen and I look at it. It's a white envelope with three blue sloping letters in the corner. NHS. I open it and pull out a letter. Like every woman over 50, I'm invited to attend a screening every 3 years. There's a leaflet included. It is designed, it tells me, to help me decide whether or not to attend this screening, for it is my choice. It contains mathematics. Out of every 400 women who attend, 16 women will be recalled for further tests, and out of those 16, 4 women will be diagnosed with a life-threatening condition. And out of those four women, only one will have her life saved and the other three will have had unnecessary treatment. The history of medicine is a story of tracing back from symptoms to find a cause. But now we don't wait for symptoms. We look through skin and flesh and bone, and we are finding the beginning seeds of illnesses, but we don't know which of these seeds are going to develop into something life-threatening, and which will live happily inside our bodies and be buried inside us as we reach our natural lifespan. We don't know everything. But we do know about mathematics, and I look at the numbers. Out of four women, one will have her life saved and the other three will have had unnecessary treatment. That is a 75% chance of overdiagnosis. If I attend this screening, I have more chance of having unnecessary treatment than I do of having my life saved. I replace the letter and the leaflet in the envelope, put it in my study on my writing desk, and within hours it is lost among papers and books and discarded ideas. It is November. Mushrooms bloom on the forest floor, and under the cold soil the roots are still. My diary is open on my desk and tells me that today I have an appointment with my family doctor. I've been getting increasingly tired while driving from city to sea, and it is no ordinary tiredness. It feels as though the skin on my eyelids has thickened and they can no longer remain open. And when it happens, I open the window to allow in cold, fast air. I put on music so loud it hurts, and I slap myself until my skin is sore and red. But 3 days ago, I was woken by the sound of the tyres upon the cat's eyes. The doctor tells me we will need to run some tests. He tells me that because I have told him, I can no longer drive. And then, before I leave, we talk about health and politics, as we always do. And I remember the invitation to the screening. I ask what he thinks about the risk of overdiagnosis. He looks at me with a steady eye. It's a good program, he says, and I think you should go. At home, I try to get back into my work, but my mind is refusing. There is something. And then I know what it is. It is the appointment for the scan. He has told me I should go, and now I feel I have to. I search through papers, books, discarded ideas, and I find the letter. I scan it for the date of the appointment. It is today. I look for the time. It is in exactly 1 hour from now. The unit is in the back of an articulated lorry up three metal steps. I'm shown into a small changing room where I take off my clothes and put on a worn, washed cotton gown. The fabric is unfamiliar on my skin and reminds me of the existence of my own body. A woman takes me into the back room and presses my breasts between sheets of glass. She looks at the images. All fine, she says, and I'm free to go. November, and he has taken over the driving, and I am now in the passenger seat. We drive from city to sea, along the motorway through the forest, into suburban streets, under the railway, up the hill. Home, the smell of salt and privet. When I open the door, there is another letter waiting for me. It has the same three blue letters, NHS. I hold it. I turn it over and over, as though the paper is hot in my hand, as though it will burn my skin. I finally rip it open. It is a letter, an invitation to a recall. I am one of the 16 women. Stop. When I made the decision to do this, to tell you my story, I made a vow to myself. I would be honest. I would tell you the truth. I knew what was in that letter before I opened it. I don't know how I knew, but I was as certain as I am that at the end of today, the sun will set in the west and the moon will rise in the east. I know the difference between truth and fiction. I am a writer. The hospital is new and smells of paint and carpet. The receptionist finds my name at the end of the list and a clinic begins. A woman in a blue uniform comes through the double doors, and although my name is last on the list, she calls it first. I follow her into a room and she sits opposite me. "Did you bring a friend?" she asks. "No," I say. She looks down at a piece of paper in her hand. She looks up at me, leans forward. "We have found," she says, "an area of grave concern." Stop. I knew what she would say, and I knew what was in that letter. I knew, and it's not the first time that I've known. I am 18 years old. I'm living in a bedsit carved from a ballroom of what had once been a grand house. I have a feeling. It is as strong as anything ever felt by a migrating bird. I need to go home. And although I have a car outside, I know I can't drive. I need a taxi. I empty my purse and begin to count notes and coins. And then the phone rings, and a voice tells me that my father has died. I'm 27 years old. I'm standing in the hallway of my house, and in my arms is my first newborn son. The phone rings, and before I touch the receiver, I know who it is. It is the woman in the opposite bed in the maternity hospital, and I know why she is ringing. It is to tell me she has found her daughter in her crib, blue-lipped and breathless. I am 35 years old. Two friends have argued. I pick up the phone, and I hand it to one of them, and I force them to speak. 4 days later, the other one dies. I don't pretend to understand. I'm just telling you the truth of what happened. I am still here, still sitting opposite my woman in blue. "An area of grave concern," she said. And even now, here, I am thinking about language. And I think, why would you use that word, grave? She tells me they are going to do a series of tests. In the first room, there is a cubicle for me to change in, screened off to protect my modesty, even though they're about to perform a series of tests on my naked breasts. I don't draw the curtain as I strip off. The woman stands at her machine with her white coat and straight blonde hair. She clamps my breasts between sheets of glass. I'm given a gown and carry my clothes into the next room where there is a radiologist looking at the images which have been sent to her screen. She asks me to lie back for an examination. She wears a plain gold wedding ring and rubs her hands together. She apologises for them being cold. And I think she must make good pastry, for you need cool hands to make good pastry, and I know why. It is because warm hands melt the fat, and that is why rolling pins are made of marble. She asks me to raise my arm. Her fingers move in circles, move, move, circle, stop. "There," she says. She takes my left hand and raises it, shows me how to feel it. A lump deep inside the breast tissue, it is well hidden. "I would never have found it," I say. "I know," she says. I shake my head and I think of the 75% of women who are overdiagnosed, and I say it to her. I must be one of those three women. "No," she says. "No, you are not." She holds up her hands, her cool fingers and her wedding band gold and plain. Although she says that machine next door can see beneath your skin and send images to my screen instantaneously, this is the single most accurate diagnostic tool. The fingers of an experienced radiologist. And even now, even here in this exchange between two women, there is beauty. It is time for the next room. I lie back and they insert a fine needle into my breast, into the lump, and take samples. I'm lying back on the bed, only I am not, for I'm also up on the ceiling looking down on myself watching, for I have a splinter of ice in my heart and in my eye, for I am a writer. I am back with my woman in blue. She hands me a piece of paper, a hospital appointment in 10 days' time to get the results of the biopsy. She asks me how I feel, and I begin to talk too much about inconsequential matters, whether I can swim tomorrow with this dressing on my breast, whether I should catch the train home or maybe the bus. And my voice is light and easy, and I see her look at me. I know what she thinks, for I am up there on the ceiling watching this scene. I am watching myself, and I am watching her watching me. I see everything. I know she thinks I am in denial. She tells me that she can't allow me to leave without realizing the gravity of all that has happened. I promise I understand. As I leave through the double doors, I look back. I have left part of myself behind, a petri dish of samples, from the most tender, story-filled part of me. We meet and walk together to a restaurant. It is just the two of us, and we agree not to tell anyone else, not until we know. The waiter shows us to our table and we order drinks and we start to talk. We have to make quick decisions and put some things on hold. I am angry. This is my time after my children have left. And the waiter comes over and he asks if we're ready to order. And we say, no, give us time. And then I begin to cry from fear, from frustration, from anger. But the waiter comes back and he asks again if we're ready to order. And I have a wet face and it's obvious I'm crying, but he just stands there. We say, no, give us time. But he comes back again and again and it's really obvious and he's being really, really stupid. And in the end, I say, just bring me a bloody margarita just to get rid of him. That night, he sleeps in the bed next to me. He smells of the last 28 years. I can't sleep. Moonlight leaks through the sides of the blind and my breast is sore. I'm here in bed beside him, but I'm also somewhere else. I'm in another bedroom, a room from the past. It is also lit by the moon and in the corner, my firstborn son sleeps in the same crib I slept in as a baby. He moves in his sleep and lets out a small cry of hunger. Across the room, my body responds to his call and I feel a surge in my breasts. I climb out of bed and pick him up. He smells of milk and of him and of me and of the moon. I hold him to my shoulder and take him into my bed and I put him upon my breast. As he drinks, the milk is let down and I become part of the unbroken chain of human history. Woman to woman, breast to breast, milk to milk, which stretches back into the black dark, the cold flat unknown, before we stood up, before we knew who we were. I cannot sleep. All I can think of is that my breast, which once gave life, can now take it away. It is December. Time passes if you give it enough time, and even 10 days pass if you give them 10 days. I'm sitting in front of the consultant and his cuffs are starched white, gold cufflinks. He smiles, asks me what I do. I tell him I'm a writer. Oh, he says, I have a lot of writers. And I'm instantly angry. I think, no, you don't, for there aren't any real writers here. I mean, not real writers. And I begin to justify my work to prove I'm a real writer. And I realise I'm angry and I'm ridiculous. And then finally we begin. Tell me, he says, what did they tell you in the clinic? And from my position up on the ceiling, I think, clever move. Make the patient say the word. And so I answer his question. They didn't allow me to leave without thinking I had cancer. He nods. They were right, he says. Stop. I'm sitting opposite the consultant who tells me I need an operation. He consults the diary and we agree a date 2 days before Christmas. The nurse gives me a folder to read. It is pink. I hate the colour pink. It has neither the red of blood nor the white of snow. I carry my pink folder to the clinic for a pre-operative check. I place it on the chair next to me and a young woman sits down, picks up my folder, thinking it is reading material. And when my name is called, I put out my hand to get the folder back. And she realises. Her face reddens and she drops the folder on the chair and she stands and rushes out. And in that small exchange, I see my story through her eyes. I see how I will be seen by others and how I would see myself if I was not at the centre of my own narrative. The exhilaration begins to cool. We go to a bar. There are Christmas lights, music, office parties. And then my phone rings, but it is too loud, so I step outside and it's cold, really cold, and I don't have my coat. It's the nurse from today, the one who gave me the pink folder. She has called, she says, to see if I'm all right. I tell her about the tiredness I felt driving and how I didn't want to go to the screening and how I knew all of this would happen. She tells me she is not surprised. She tells me that the body is mysterious and knows things. She tells me she will see me when I come back for the operation. I thank her and the call ends. December. He drops me at the hospital doors and I hold my bag to my chest like a breastplate, like armour. They weigh me, measure me, and then the surgeon comes in. He fills in the paperwork and I'm watching him and I see he wears blue rubber clogs, which he thinks are dark enough to hide marks. But I can see the glitter of old blood stains. I sign the consent form. We haven't, he said, discussed scars or disfigurement. No, I say, we haven't. He asks me how I feel about it. I say, well, I can't allow myself to be overly concerned as it might prevent me from having the operation. And if I don't have the operation, then it will kill me. And then there would be no need to worry about disfigurement. We both laugh. He tells me I have a pragmatic mind. It contains a splinter of ice. When I wake, I am speaking Spanish. Do you need an interpreter? The nurse asks. No, no, I'm English and I speak English, I say. Only I say it in Spanish. The more they ask, the more I protest, but always in Spanish. My English only returns when I drink my tea. Between Christmas and the New Year, the doctor's surgery is cold where the heating has been off. The nurse changes the dressing. And then back home, I think it is time. I go into my bedroom and close the door. I am alone. Stand in front of the mirror and undress. But before I turn to look at myself, I think I have a choice in how I see this. The silver world of the mirror looks at me. I see a long red cut down the side of my breast. And I recognise it. It is another scar, a scar to join the other scars, which will together tell the story of my body. January. There is a frost outside and the leaves are white. I am in the hospital waiting to get the results from the operation and I cannot speak. Fear has locked my jaw. And the chair is plastic and the backs of my thighs are sweating. But the surgeon has good news. It hasn't spread into the lymphatic system. I just need radiotherapy and drugs for 5 years and the tumour is hormone sensitive and in my case, if I take the medication, I'll have 40% less chance of a recurrence. I ask about side effects. Very few, he says. He smiles. But if you feel like you want to murder someone, do come back to see me. It is a sharp January day. I'm in my local high street going to the chemist and in my pocket is my prescription and a man stops me. He is my family doctor. It is you, isn't it? He says. I just got the letter about your diagnosis. I'm so sorry. And there in the street, he slips off his sheepskin gloves, tucks them both under one arm. He takes both of my hands in his two hands and holds them. His skin is warm and dry. I'll warn you, he says, that this is very difficult. It is always difficult. I don't know why, but it is. I nod and say nothing, but in my mind, I think, I know why it is difficult. This tender, story-filled part of me. Come and see me if there is anything I can do for you, he says. I am always here. And he walks away. I take my tablets to a cafe and sit at the table. I open the box and pull out the information sheet, read about the side effects. There is a possibility of joint pain, but that can be counteracted with painkillers. There is a possibility of severe depression, but there are antidepressants. There is a possibility of vaginal atrophy, but there are lubricants. There is a possibility of erosion of the bones leading to fractures, but that can be prevented with calcium and B3. There is a possibility of extreme hot flushes, but they can be treated with a wonder drug which was originally developed for seizures. 40% less chance of a recurrence, I think. I hold the blister pack, push the plastic until the fine metal covering rips and the tablet lands in the palm of my hand. A perfect white circle. I pick up the glass of transparent water, place the pill in my mouth and swallow. February and spring is a broken promise. For 6 days I swallow the pills, good girl, good girl, good girl, and on the seventh day I wake. But the house is silent. He has gone. The sun is high and my body is heavy in the bed. It is midday. I get out of bed, but my hips are sore and metal spikes have been driven up into my heels. I tell myself, go to the bathroom. I tell myself, have something to eat. My head is heavy. And it feels empty. The day is empty. It is, I am. The phone rings and they ask for my address. But I don't remember the postcode. Are you all right? The voice asks. When he comes home, I'm on the sofa with a remote control in my hand. This isn't like you, he says. But it is me. Look, I look the same. At night, my bed becomes a river. It is wet and there is green weed and there are fish. Even my shins sweat. Every day I wake at noon and take another tablet. 5 years. March. I'm sitting in the chair and he's sitting opposite me. His cuffs are still starched, still held together with gold links. I tell him I asked to come and see him because I realise I am made up of words. Without the ability to create sentences, I don't know who I am. I only know what I was. The drugs were too strong, he says. You can come off them, and after radiotherapy, when the tissue is healed, you can try again. He looks in his diary. Come back on April the 1st, he says. You'll remember that. For 6 days, I do not take the tablets. Then on the 7th day, I wake. It is a March morning and I am in bed. The early sun comes through the blinds and my mind is a stream of words. He is still asleep. I push back the covers and get up, and my hips are oiled and the metal spikes have been taken out of my heels. I pull on clothes, run down the stairs and leave the house. I stand on the cliff top and look down on the beach, and birds fly over me, birds fly under me. They are miracles of bone and feather, and the sea is a silver disc. The world is beautiful again. My body is mine again, and I know who I am again. Radiotherapy is like topless quasar. I lie back, my arms in a brace. They are in uniform and they check the equipment, calling numbers out to each other. Then they go behind a glass screen and they fire beams of light at me. And I have turned it into a game. It is them against me. I have to drive myself there every day, and I have to work. I'm writing the draft of a play which I'm determined to finish before the end of treatment. Only in the third week the tiredness bites. And even though I am unstoppable, I am stoppable. It's April the 1st, All Fool's Day. I have a new packet of tablets. Different tablets. I tell myself all will be fine. I swallow the first pill. For 6 days I swallow and for 6 days I work. And then on the 7th day I wake and again he is gone and again I am alone. I go into my study and look at the play I am writing, but I don't understand the words on the page and I don't understand the gaps between the lines. And then that night, the river returns to my bed. Stop. I have listened enough. It's time for me to learn for myself, to get informed. It is time for me to get an education. I sit up straight, I sharpen my pencil, I get books and papers and research. And though my mind is waterlogged, I begin. This is an ancient disease, and the first mention of it is in hieroglyphics. I read of how they developed mastectomies, which were first performed with no anaesthetic. And I read about the confusion about why some women survived and some didn't. And then they realized it was because of how far the disease had spread through the body. If the disease had already spread, removing breasts and muscle wouldn't save them. And if it hadn't spread, there was no need to remove a whole breast. I read about how the pattern of each cancer is entirely individual. Cells travel through the body, and if they are sticky, they form tumours and are easier to remove. I read about the development of radiotherapy, and I read about Marie Curie and how she kept her samples in test tubes inside her pockets. And how at night she would place them in her desk drawer, observing their glow as she shut them into the dark. And of how her research books and even her cookbook are still radioactive and have to be kept in lead boxes. And then I read of the development of chemotherapy. And then I read of the development of medication. I find an online tool called Predict. And if I put the information about my illness from the pathology report into it, it is going to tell me the likelihood of me being alive in 5 years' time. I enter the details. I press return and a bar chart appears. There is a line on the bar. This, it states, represents the difference between the women who take the drugs and the women who don't. Now, I expect the line to be wide to represent the fact that if I take the drugs, I will be 40% less likely to have a recurrence. But the line is thin. And the difference over 5 years, it states, is 0.6%. I look at this line at this bar chart for a long time. I re-enter the information and I press return, and it is the same. And while I stare at the figures, I realise my education needs to be expanded to include statistics. I begin to examine the way that risk can be presented, and I find there are two basic ways of presenting statistics: absolute and relative. Let me say we have 100 women here who don't take the drug for 5 years. And we have 100 women here who do take the drug for 5 years. In that time, three of these women who don't take the drugs get a recurrence. And two of these women who do take the drugs get a recurrence. The difference between these groups of women is 1%. That's one woman in 100, 1%. And that is the absolute statistic. But let's look at the difference between the two women here and the three women here. Three is 50% bigger than two. Therefore, the relative statistic, where I'm looking at how these two statistics relate to each other, is 50%. Now, in my case, the absolute statistic is 0.6%, but the relative statistic is 40%. Therefore, if I choose not to take the drugs, I have a 0.6% higher chance of a recurrence. But my mind is not satisfied. There is something else. I know I have read something, and I look through everything. I reread everything, and finally I find it. A footnote in an academic paper, italics, 10.7 words. The cause of death is not stated. And it's then that the realization comes that these two women and these three women, they may have died of other things. It is the next April morning. I wake late and go down into the kitchen, and the blister pack of white circles waits for me on the side. I look at it. I pick it up, turn it over in my hand. I feel them, the thin foil one side, the plastic the other. Stop. I told you I would be honest. It is not easy. However much I tell myself about the difference between relative and absolute statistics, it makes no difference. Fear is not interested in rational thinking. Fear has invaded my every thought. Fear is with me from the moment I wake until the moment I sleep. And these round white tablets have become talismans, charms. They are rabbit's feet, they are a pig's heart in a chimney, they are a cat buried beneath a new house. And this is the other thing, my body is not just mine. I am a mother, a lover, a daughter, a sister. And other people have fear. I'm holding the blister pack of tablets and I turn them over, examine them. I look at the plastic, the foil, the perfect white circles. And then I put them down. Every morning I enter the kitchen and I look at them, but I do not touch and I say nothing. And then on the seventh day, we are all in the car. My eldest son is in the back with me and we are talking and laughing. And then he stops and he looks at me. He says, I am not going to collude with you. It is that obvious. May, a month of chlorophyll. I am in the hospital waiting room. The oncologist clinic is running late and I'm head down deep in a book. My name isn't called. I go to find the nurse and she tells me the clinic has finished, that I'd been shown to the wrong room. I have been so strong through all of this, but now, for the first time, I lose control. Let me make a call, she says. I will find her. And finally she does. I can come back in the afternoon. The oncologist is sitting at her desk. "Please," she says, "take a seat." I sit down and she asks me how I am, about the radiotherapy, about my skin. And then I say, "Can I talk something through with you?" And she says, "Of course, you can have as much time as you need." I talk through my research. And once I start, I cannot stop. I go through it all with her, from hieroglyphics to bar chart. And we talk of the difference between the relative and absolute statistics. I tell her everything. I tell her how I realise that my mind is made up of words and that these were my years when my sons had left and I was about to find out what this next stage of my life had to offer. She listens and then she speaks. "Some people think they've done their research," she says, "but you have. I think you've interpreted this correctly. And in your case, if I were you, I wouldn't take them." June. The nights are short and the days are long. In the last 2 weeks, something has happened. Time has divided. I once lived in one time frame, but now I live in two. In one timeline, I find the letter and the appointment is for the day before, and I don't make the call to rearrange. I get more and more tired, and then I begin to feel ill. I'm undergoing tests, but deep inside my body, in a dark, dark place, deep beneath tissue, out of the reach of fingertips, cells multiply and spread. In the other timeline, this one, I go to the screening and I get the treatment, and when the drugs tarnish my mind, I decide not to take them. And in this timeline, something is happening. I watch myself, and I am doing things I don't understand. It is pre-language from back then. It is ancient. I go to the hairdresser and ask them to cut off my hair so that it is natural, grey. I wipe my face clean of makeup. I stop wearing deodorant and occasionally put my nose to my armpit, and I like what I smell. I remove a silver bracelet, thinking I have a rash. There is no rash, but I don't replace it. I remove all my bracelets, one by one. I strip the colour from my clothes, and I wear only black and silver. And then, in this timeline, I walk out of my house, past the smell of privet blossom, through the salt air, onto the cliff. I watch the birds, and then I go down to sea level. I undress. I step into the water and the cold grips my ankles and my thighs. It drenches my breasts. I go under the surface and it is cold and it feels as though it is soaking into my mind. I am being cleansed. October until June. It has been 9 months. A gestation. And now, at last, I can see the shape of it, and I can see what it is that has happened. In these 9 months, I have given birth to a whole new self. I stand here, here, and in my arms I hold this new self. I look at her. She is wet, bloody. She is fierce. She is without fear. For she has tasted fear, and she knows what it is like. It is not like this. This new self can stand on a stage in the lights and look at the faces and eyes without wanting to step back, back, back into that black, into the dark where it was all flat and before we knew who we were. This new self, I, can speak these words which I have written. This new self, I, can say and do whatever, whatever I want.
In three letters, Nell Leishen was telling her own story. It was directed in Edinburgh by Susan Roberts.
And you can find more editions of Drama on 3 on the BBC Radio 3 website.
If everything is worthy of outrage, then essentially nothing is.
In our biological and social evolution, what has made us so angry?
It's a kind of righteous anger. Sometimes it can be vicious and sometimes it can be personalised.
The journalist Oliver Berkman tries to understand anger in today's world.
News stories that make people angry are more likely to be shared than other sorts of news stories.
You are communicating that to your entire social network all at once, that could be hundreds or even thousands of people.
Oliver Berkman, Why Are We So Angry? This Wednesday morning at 9:30 on BBC Radio 4.
This is BBC Radio 3. It's 9:15 and time for this evening's Radio 3 in Concert. Here's Kate Mollison.
Good evening. Well, tonight is a bit like one of those hypothetical dinner parties. If you could invite any famous person, who would you, etc., etc.? Well, I guess the musical equivalent is possibly the Verbier Festival. Super glitzy lineup in the Swiss Alps. It's a Davos summit equivalent in classical music. Top soloists from around the world turning up and playing chamber music together against a backdrop of glittering lakes under snow-peaked mountains. That's just an average year, so imagine what the gathering must have been like in July this year for the 25th anniversary of Verbier Festival, when many lustrous artists from past editions returned for a mega concert with two intervals. Actually, don't have to imagine it because I'm about to play you highlights from that concert, starting with a supergroup to end all supergroups. Violinists Pinkas Zukerman, Maxim Vengerov, Vladim Rapin, Leonidas Kavakos, Vilde Frang, Ilya Gringolts, Lisa Batiashvili and Renaud Capuçon. So when's the last time any of them played rank and file in an orchestra? And then we have the viola players Tabea Zimmerman, Noboko Imai and Gerard Cosset. And on cello we have Misha Majski, Andrei Yanitsa and Edgar Moreau. So this is a ridiculously plush rendition of Bach's Brandenburg Concerto No. 3.